Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
And tame again.
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
Four-star Haaland. Who's actually doing the toasting and spreading when a winger has a fullback on toast? Whose hands is the Women's Super League title race actually in? Gary Cotterill doing Gary Cotterill things. Letting Ipswich fans enjoy their fun before the reality supposedly kicks in. £7,000 a term Galactico choristers. An epic bit of boathing. One of the most elaborate football analogies in political history. And Keys and Gray's official new refereeing admin nemesis is crowned. Brought to your ears by Goalhanger Podcasts. This is Football Clichés. Hello everyone, welcome to Football Clichés. I'm Adam Hurry, and with me on the adjudication panel today, first of all, David Walker. Hello, how are you doing?
Hello, yeah, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Charlie Eccleshare is in Rome covering the tennis this week. Listen, fair play.
Yeah.
So Nick Miller is here for his 63rd Clichés appearance. In England cap terms, Nick, that puts you level with your Kevin Keegans, your Alan Shearers. Not bad.
Oh, Alan Shearer. Only 63 caps. Surprising.
I know. Injury got in the way there. Glad you're here, actually, because I saw a piece this weekend from The Athletic's deputy language of football correspondent, Nick Miller, entitled Squeaky Bums and Bottle Jobs, How to Speak Football at the End of the Season. Good job. I enjoyed it. Some imprecision that I wanted to sort of pin you down on. Run-in, you say, is equal to the last few games, usually for those with something at stake. Well, how many? How many is it?
I should have known that this would get picked up on when I agreed to this. I don't know. I don't think my remit was to be that precise, but now I realise that I should have...
If you're going to explain stuff to Americans, you really want to have the detail ready, don't you?
I suppose run-in is probably about 8 on 9. Dave Walker is holding up two hands, I think, to indicate 10.
It depends a bit on the context, I think. I think once you get to like last 10 games, that is a marker.
I agree with you. I think it should be 10, but then I start to think of it as a proportion of the season, and that's nearly a third, and that worries me too. But the overriding factor here, Nick, is how many games can you feasibly fit on a Sky Sports graphic when you sort of put three teams next to each other and assess how many games they've got left and crucially who they've got to play. And I think 10 games is a comfortable, acceptable window for that. To dig into who they've got to play.
In that context, 10 is good for just if you're just looking at one team. I think if you've got 10 on for three different teams, that becomes a bit
unwieldy.
That's
quite busy, isn't it?
All right. I think you've got to, if you're doing the three title challenges or whatever, you've got to limit it to sort of five or six in that very specific scenario. Particularly as you kind of, they always sort of stagger it as to when the games actually are as well. So they're all slightly different levels.
Yeah, and someone always has a game in hand, which ruins it as well.
Can I return briefly to last week's episode that we did with Gary Lineker? At the start of that episode, we had a clip of former Ipswich defender Alex Bruce talking about Ipswich. They used the phrase tickly bit to describe this current phase of the season that they were in. And I actually don't think we got it quite right. I think we did it a slight disservice, actually.
Okay.
Because I think there is a particularly... There is something... I don't know whether tickly bit's necessarily the right way to describe it, but that phase of the season that a club like Ipswich are in, or any club in the EFL, so it's when they kind of know they've done it, but they've got games in hand to play against teams that are pretty much relegated or just have nothing to play for. They're expected to win. They kind of know they're going to win. They may even be in a position where, like, the goal difference is such that they're all but up, but you still have to go and do the job. I think that is a bit different to say than I don't think it's right to say call that like squeaky bum time. So yeah. I don't think there's as much nervousness and pressure, but it's kind of annoying. You kind of know, just sort of this annoying little tickly bit.
Well, that's a lot more nuanced than we suggested it might be. So I'm glad you've revisited it, actually, because that makes a hell of a lot more sense. Because tickly bit really taps into that nuance, Nick. It's just that subtle sensation rather than being anything overwhelming or, you know, potentially damaging to your season's chances.
Yeah, I mean, do you mean this basically we should win these, but we might not? Like a kind of, in snooker, like a black off the spot with a bit of a dicey angle. You should get it, but it's tickly enough for you to...
We know you've been spending your weekend.
Yep. Absolutely, 100%. Wife walked in. When have you watched snooker before? Yeah, well, this is important. This is important.
Oh, wow, fair play. But yeah, this sort of language is pervading society. Here's Paddy O'Connell on BBC Radio 4 on Sunday talking about the mayoral elections up and down the country.
And here's the declaration in Birmingham, with just 1,500 votes separating the Conservative Andy Street and Labour's Richard Parker. It was... squeaky brum time.
Happy with that?
Yeah,
it's
like
tapping,
it.
Tapping, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's fine. It's a classic satisfying pun, that, I think.
And it's not a reach at all. It works really well. So, yeah, more on politics colliding with football in a linguistic sense later on. Right, let's kick off the adjudication panel with this. We talked about this a lot on this podcast, Dave, about the misuse of 4-star when teams win, you know, 4-1 or 4-0. This is an extension of this. The Guardian headline, 4-star Haaland shines as Manchester City sink Wolves in title pursuit. I mean, that's even more egregious, isn't it?
Yeah.
If a player scores 4 goals and is then heralded as a 4-star performance. Very concerning.
Really doing him a disservice. Absolutely, yeah. It just, there's so many different ways you could describe a fantastic performance. You even need to go to the stars system here at all.
Yeah. It's just so irresistible, the star system, Nick, isn't it?
I think I may even know whoever wrote that headline. I'm tempted to get in touch with them to say, what else could he have done exactly to earn that extra star? Come on,
yeah.
Come on, guys.
Use your contacts. That would be great. Yeah. But let's introduce a little bit of mitigation here, which I don't think it is, by the way. He completed his hat-trick in the opening 45 minutes, which, if anything, is an embellishment of his performance. But two of them were penalties. So does that bring it back down to 4-star, Dave? I mean, you know... It arguably does. It's not quite the 4-goal haul you should expect from a top striker.
If anything, as we discussed before, you know, you can have 7-star luxury hotels. 4 goals with the first half hat-trick might even be more than 5-star performance. Could be.
Maybe they're going for the, you know, the famed American film critic Roger Ebert.
Yeah. Prolific.
Famously only gave films ranking out of 4. He gave like half stars. So if film was really good but not quite perfect, it would be 3.5 stars. So maybe they're adhering to that. It seems unlikely, but maybe.
What a weirdly awkward scoring system that is. Fair enough. I don't know. Maybe 4 is less cumbersome than 5. Dave, as a noted pubsman yourself, you might enjoy this. You may have heard rhetoric like this in recent times. Andy Cooper writes in, says the Saturday lunchtime kickoff between Arsenal and Bournemouth, a bloke in the pub shouted, "Go on, Saka, put him on toast," as he ran at the fullback. Is it the winger's job to actually put the fullback on toast? He's either got him on there or he hasn't, right? Well, there's two issues here, Dave. First of all, a disgusting thing for anyone to shout in any context. I don't like that at all.
Yeah, it is weird, isn't it? I don't think I've ever heard anyone shout that before. I mean, what sort of things... I suppose you kind of would hear someone, you know, when a winger's got a fullback one-on-one, you might hear, go on, skin him, I think.
Yeah.
It's like one you'd go for, or run in, go, but like, go on, put him on toast. It's just, it doesn't quite work, does it?
The problem here, Nick, is that you're applying a kind of medium-sized picture concept to a individual isolated incident. And I think that's where the real jarring occurs here. The putting of a fullback on toast by a winger should be a 90-minute affair, or at least an hour-long affair of torridness, not an individual thing. Unless, of course, it was the tipping point for Saka to put the fullback on toast. Maybe he already skinned him 3 times and that this would have been the tipping point. I mean, maybe we should ask the guy.
Yeah, you wouldn't say... It's in the same kind of family as someone shouting, "Tie him in knots," or something, isn't it? Yeah,
twist his blood!
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, because you can't, like, the fullback, in theory, depending on what minute of the game this was, as you say, like, what if the fullback had kind of really digs in, sticks to his task, and has kind of...
Untoasts himself.
Yeah, can you untoast yourself? You can't. You can't unbutter yourself.
scraping yourself off the toast. I put jam on by mistake.
I'm not really sure why, but also in my head it was said in sort of Pathé News voice. Like, give him a totted time, Saka, or something along those lines.
The final dilemma that Andy Cooper poses here, Nick, is that is it actually the winger's job, in the proverbial sense, to put the fullback on toast, or does it simply happen? Is it something that just simply happens? Is it an active putting on the toast by the winger of the fullback? I think it should remain a little bit more ambiguous, shouldn't it?
The attacker has to...
He's had him on toast, but that doesn't mean he himself personally put him on the toast.
Well, who's putting him on toast then?
I just think he suddenly appears there.
The waitress in a cafe? What's...
Because he could have been delivered... The analogy, Dave, could suggest that the winger has been supplied on a plate with the fullback on toast and is preparing to tuck in. It's not necessarily he slapped him on some toast and then, there you are.
Interestingly also there that you did the... It looks like you're thinking very much of like scrambled eggs or beans on toast there, because you used an imaginary knife and fork.
Yeah, that, yes.
Rather than just pick...
liquefying of the fullback and then to spread them is a little bit harsh for me. A bit medieval.
I think that fits with the spirit of it. You really kind of, you're getting the jam or your peanut butter or anything and really spreading it out.
Gruesome situation. Moving swiftly on. Emma Levin gets in touch with the Women's Super League table as it stands after the weekend. Chelsea now back in title contention, certainly mathematically. They have a game in hand over Manchester City. So they've got two games left to play. Manchester City have one. They're 3 points behind. And crucially, Nick, their goal difference is one better. So it's a difficult one. And I ended up having this argument over WhatsApp on Sunday night. She asks, is one game to go for City, two for Chelsea? Is the title in both of their own hands or neither? Whose hands is the title in? Because even if Chelsea win both games, all Manchester City have to do is win their game by more goals.
Is it both in both their hands and both in neither of their hands?
Whose hands is it predominantly in?
This is such a strange one. It's because fundamentally, if something's in your hands, you should be able to win all your games and you've won the league.
Yeah.
That should be...
Unequivocally.
Yeah. But it's so tight here that it isn't really in either of their hands, because they can both win, but they can both win their remaining fixtures and still lose the title. But they also have it within their power to score more goals than the other team.
Mm.
So it's kind of everything and nothing all at the same time.
The bookies have no idea where to go with this, Nick. Chelsea are 4-5 to win the title, and Man City are 10-11. So there's not a lot in it. But they are suggesting that it's in Chelsea's hands. Man City have got Villa left to play, which is not necessarily an easy game. Certainly doesn't suggest they're going to rack up the goals in that one either. So Chelsea got two chances to extend their goal difference, assuming they win both games. So they're probably... It is in their hands. It is in Chelsea's hands. It's in one of Chelsea's hands.
Yeah, maybe that's how we kind of divide it up. It's in one of each of their hands.
Mm. We've confronted this issue from several angles in recent past, Dave. I think it's thrown the whole in Team X's hands discourse into complete disarray. I don't think anybody knows anymore.
It should be a simple thing, as I said, but I suppose we need a different way of describing it for situations like this. I mean, it's not uncommon for a situation, you know, for a decisive situation to be this close.
Yeah, definitely. Having to speculate on goal difference, I think, completely muddies the waters, so I'm very concerned. Well, I guess we'll just have to see what happens. It's the only way to do it, isn't it? Right, next up, listener Michael Cox gets in touch. He was at a wedding at the weekend. He says the groom just said in his speech that he'd known his groomsman for a combined period of over 100 years. What a ludicrous use of combined years. It's just concurrent.
The lovely thing about that is I can imagine Coxie laughing at it on his table and no one else around him having any idea why.
How many do you think he's got? Three or four?
Must be four.
I don't know. Except it could be three. If he's kind of... If they're...
Proper childhood friends.
Yeah, school friends.
Could be three. A couple of mid-30s and an early 40s would get you over the line. Otherwise, four would be quite young, wouldn't you? You'd have sort of four, three 20-somethings and a 30-something.
Three from the top, one from the bottom, please, Carol. The idea of him just sitting there working it out before writing his speech, Nick, is quite a charming image to me. Get that one in. That's a nice little stat, isn't it?
I have got to write a best man speech in the coming week, so I'm now considering bringing stats into the equation. Haven't really thought of it before. And as a best man speech, there's a slightly different vibe to a groom speech, but I'm going to crunch some numbers.
Sprinkle in some insight. Never did anyone any harm. Heat maps, something like that. I don't know. Right, time for footballers' names in things. First one comes from Robert Redding. Here's journalist and author Malcolm Gladwell as one of the latest guests on the podcast No Small Endeavour. Who else knew that the goalkeeper in our pure EFL 11 had his own podcast these days?
Hello, hello. Malcolm here. Today we're sharing something a little different on Revisionist History. I'm bringing you back in time to my beginnings. I'm sharing an episode of the acclaimed podcast No Small Endeavor, where I sat down with my friend, the host, and award-winning theologian, Lee Camp.
That's a good one.
Really enjoyed that one. Look, if anyone knows about the purgatory of England under 21 and just being a perennial championship goalkeeper, it's going to be Lee Camp, right? Good start. Lovely start. Next one, I think, really flirts with the boundary of whether it's a common enough name or a footballery enough name. So interested to hear what you think about this one. Came from Ollie Bailey. It's from 1977 space hoax thriller Capricorn One.
Mr. Vice President, I hope you and Mrs. Price will be very comfortable. The agency would like you to have these commemorative binoculars to help you watch the launch and to remember this day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very nice.
What is your name, son?
Hughes, sir. Mark Hughes.
You learn pretty quick. You'll do all right.
Thank you, sir.
The reason why I think it's just the right side of the line, Dave, is I don't think any American should be called Mark Hughes.
I don't know. It's right on the borderline, isn't it? Of doesn't feel quite outlandish enough.
I mean, I reject all sorts of DM'd submissions for footballers' names in things, Nick, because they're too common a name.
Mm.
Have I, is there a case of double standards here?
What's the thinking behind the American shouldn't be called Mark Hughes?
I don't know. It just doesn't sound like a very American-y name. I don't know. Yeah, that's pretty much the extent of it. Mark Hughes.
Mark Hughes was in the Manchester United youth ranks in 1978. So,
speaking of names that really just should not be said in an American accent, almost to the point where they simply cannot be said in an American accent. This one came from Mark. He says, check out Cold Case, Season 4, Episode 12, for a footballer's name. It will surprise you.
Anyway, they got a name on that kid. Was a ringleader of this fight club. It's Cole Palmer.
He just can't say it, can they? It's like Craig.
Yeah. Palmer.
Palmer. Real mouthful for Americans. I feel for them. Good topical, real cutting edge one, Cole Palmer. 2007, that episode. So very ahead of its time. Right, little quiz for you. Dave, what is the worst kept secret in football?
Ooh. Julian Lopetegui taking over at West Ham?
Oh, a little bit ahead of the curve. Nick, any better answer than that?
On a slot at Liverpool?
Correct.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that is the worst kept secret in football by quite a mile. And poor old Arne Slot. Now, not only is he having to tie up his loose ends with Feyenoord, but he's also got Sky's Gary Cotterill on his case. The real welcome to the Premier League, that is, isn't it? Gary Cotterill is in the Netherlands doing Gary Cotterill things. The intrepid Gary Cotterill was on Sky Sports News on Monday morning interviewing a bloke who was Arne Slot's neighbour when they were kids. Good to get a bit of colour, bit of background. I'm all for it. Here's what he had to say.
This close neighbour, 2 years older than Slot, remembers him well.
A very good footballer.
What do you remember of him?
As a boy? Always playing with the ball.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Cheers, mate.
You have to kind of doff the cap slightly to Cotterill by trying to sound enthusiastic about that revelation as well. Yeah, did he? All right.
The call back to the office or to the producer saying, right, so we've done an interview with a guy who used to live next door to him. Oh, all right, great. What? He did say that he used to play football a lot. It's kind of all we've got. Will that do?
It's quite a big case, isn't it?
Yeah, my angle on this was a little bit less snidey than this. I'm not saying that speaking to Arne Slot's neighbour when they were kids is not worthy of the sort of mini featurette that he did for Sky Sports News. But my crucial thing here is that he always had a ball at his feet. Is useful for a sort of up and coming player. But I don't need to hear it about a manager. It tells me nothing.
What would you have preferred? Like he was always
had a laminated set piece folder.
Constantly playing with a tactics board.
Always saw him with a cone.
All he ever got for Christmas was a series of blue and red counters that he put on a magnetic board. Incredible.
I went round his house to play Connect Four, but he was just there on the table. Just
bloody Arne Slot. Rubbish. Right. Anyway, keep going, Gary Cotterill. We always enjoy what you do. Next up, this is from The Overlap. Lots of people sent this in. This is them discussing kids' film franchises. Ian Wright getting very emotional about Toy Story, Roy Keane throwing in a curveball, and then Jamie Carragher settling it in the most Monday Night Football way possible.
And then I've heard that there's going to be Toy Story 5, where he's looking for them for his kids.
Oh.
I can't, I'm finished. I'm going to cry now.
Oh, that is cute. You have got to be
Shrek.
Part.
Like Shrek. Shrek's funny.
Yes, Shrek was good. Awesome. I just think Toy Story was just a level above that.
I mean, we assess so many times, Dave, you know, people talking about things in a football-y way, and often it's quite jarring, and often it's kind of a bit like they're trapped in that way of thinking. In some ways, a footballer way of analysing things is so efficient. Like, there's such a good way of expressing it.
Perfect.
I hope this is how wider society should sort of assess things like this.
Yeah. And it's bang on, I think, as well, in this example.
Yeah.
Shrek, very good, but Toy Story is just that elite level.
Leads on to a discussion of what constitutes world class in the animated film stakes.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, if you were to kind of reverse this and place it back in a football context, Nick, what kind of context would it be? It would always be like a striker who is showing glimpses of being world class, but just hasn't got that kind of final finish that you can rely on.
Like, I don't know, Gabriel Jesus, is he too far below that?
Darwin Nunez, maybe? Maybe.
Yeah, too much of a comedy figure, then, I think.
Also, clearly not in the conversation for being absolutely top level,
Football hipsters probably going, you know, actually, Ants was better than A Bug's Life.
Throwing these film titles at me, and I've never seen them, and I'm delighted to say so. But my favourite thing about it, Dave, is that, whilst we're analysing it in this kind of context, I don't think there's any irony from Carragher here. This is how his brain works, and rightly so.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Good. Glad to hear it. Right. Lovely piece of framing in this match report, Nick. It came from Arthur Fane. It's the BBC match report for Coventry 1 Ipswich 2 the other day, and it went as follows. After starting the second half sluggishly, Coventry then somehow found a way back into the game following a change of match official, when referee James Bell went off to be replaced by Dean Whitestone. Almost immediately, on 54 minutes, Hadji Wright turned to fire in a low right foot shot and stunned the visiting away corner. The implication here that it galvanised them is brilliant. Why would it?
Match report as written by Nottingham Forest social media team.
Come on, boys. Clean slate now. Okay.
What has that new referee injected into the game? Just a bit of urgency.
Maybe would the totting up scale, will he have been paying attention if he's the fourth official?
You couldn't take the totting up process seriously if it was a new ref. Like, how do you know?
Yeah.
Pointing at all the wrong places on the pitch. A weirdly leading kind of phrasing in that match report. Almost immediately. Like the instant impact of this referee on proceedings. Anyway, speaking of Ipswich, Nick, I've seen at least two pieces in the last few days along the lines of enjoy it while it lasts, Ipswich, but you're getting pummeled in the Premier League. Setting aside the specifics of Ipswich for the moment, is this in the wrong spirit, this sort of discourse? Because it might just be a reflection of the financial realities of the gulf between the Premier League and the Championship. But is there some sort of grace period where you shouldn't have to sort of speculate on their fate in the Premier League? Should you let them bask in their glory for a little while? Is that just romantic nonsense?
No, I absolutely think they should. It's all very mean-spirited. It's a little bit kind of jealous of someone else having a nice time. It's about like saying, well, you're having a nice time on your birthday now, but you are going to die at some point. So, you know, what's the point?
that is one way of putting it. There's also this tendency now, and I imagine a lot of us are guilty of it, Dave, this kind of pigeonholing of promoted teams, this idea that if you play good football and storm your way out of the Championship, you're going to come undone in the Premier League with this if you don't become a little bit more streetwise. You know, I have, you know, explicitly seen people saying Ipswich are going to be the new Burnley. They're going to be too naive when they go up.
Yeah.
Should we be cleverer than this?
We should.
You know, just saying that one team's fortunes are going to happen to the next team, or does that reflect the brutal realities of going from the Championship to the Premier League?
I think there is a genuine concern that it is getting harder because of growing inequality between top and bottom. But also, I think there's a massive slice of recency bias here in that you've had, in particular, Burnley and Sheffield United, two teams who have been well off it this season, despite the fact that Burnley could actually somehow miraculously still stay up. But, you know, those two teams were teams that, you know, without getting too Guardian Football Weekly about this all, but like they were two teams that they lost their good players in the summer and they didn't really replace them effectively. They lost like loan players, and Sheffield United sold a couple of players and stuff. So there were some specifics around this season as to why those three teams, promoted teams, have been as bad as they have. And Luton, it was always going to be difficult for Luton, and they've given it a good go but ultimately come up short. Whereas the season before, all three promoted teams stayed up.
This happens all the time, Nick, you know, sort of general coverage, general observations of a certain team, and then a fan base saying, well, no, there are more specific things going on here. Don't do us a disservice. Are Ipswich the latest victims of what I can only term as doing a Team X kind of chat? Is that we're so obsessed with transposing one team's kind of experience onto the upcoming fortunes of another. I mean, it's tidy in many ways. What is the ultimate doing a Team X? Is it doing a Leeds, isn't it? I mean, it has its own Wikipedia page, of course.
It's also particularly irritating because I imagine almost all of the people that have been saying this won't have watched Ipswich. They'll have just kind of read a couple of pieces where there's some reference made to their style. Young, presumably progressive coach, don't know, never watched them. so they're just kind of transposing that.
Increases the mystique if you don't really know anything about them anyway. So it does work in the other direction.
It does.
Sometimes.
But I was going to say, on the flip side, there is also a lot of talk around a team who have done as well as Ipswich, even maybe Leicester as well. And a lot of people go, oh, they'll be fine next year. You know, I look at them and I think they'll be fine in the Premier League next year. You know, they'll establish themselves. And again, it's like, well, will they? I don't know.
Right. I want to end part one with this. This came from Joshua Jones. Here's Peter Crouch canvassing opinion at Villa Park before the Europa Conference League clash with Olympiacos.
So now let's hear how much it means to the Villa faithful. Crouchy's been catching up with a few fans in the bar at the Holt End.
What do you make of the season so far? Like, it's just a roller coaster, isn't it? It seems to get better and better.
A delightful return for us, Dave, to roller coaster chat. That's just not how roller coasters work, is it? Or do they?
Well, you do want them to reach something of a climax, but
it's always going to peter out, though. A roller coaster. That's the point of them.
It's got to bring you back down to earth at the end.
Even roller coasters that just go up for ages with the promise of being a massive plunge at the end of it, that isn't necessarily getting better and better. Is it? That's just steadily... It's the same experience until you get to the top. That's not necessarily getting better just because you're higher, is it?
I don't know. It depends if you're like a real adrenaline junkie and it's getting better and better as you go up higher and then go faster, but then it's going to stop, isn't it?
Above everything else, that is not the accepted use of the roller coaster analogy, so not happy with it at all. Brings us to the end of part one. See you very shortly. Welcome back to Football Clichés, the adjudication panel. Before we kick off the second half, a reminder that the Football Clichés merchandise range is available. T-shirts in black and white and very tastefully decorated mugs are available. I don't want to overdo the sales so far, Dave, but they're selling well, so get in there is the message, isn't it?
Yeah, I was thinking that normally this would be a perfect time of year to buy a T-shirt. Summer very much upon us. But as we sit here on Bank Holiday Monday, it is pissing down. So perhaps we should have done some Clichés umbrellas or something.
Hot cup of tea, though. That'd be all right. Hot cup of tea in a lovely mug. Yeah. And if they sell out, we'll just replenish the stock. That's how commerce works. Right, let's kick off part two. This came from Alex Smith, who refers us, Nick, to a popular publication, Tatler's School Guide 2024. And the entry for Christchurch Cathedral School, which claims it was described by one visitor as the Real Madrid of the chorister world. Alex adds a little bit of detail. He says, I attended there for my sins in the early 2000s. Would that make me the Jonathan Woodgate of the chorister world? Would you want to be the Real Madrid of cathedral schools, do you think?
I mean, I suppose so. I mean, firstly, I'd like to hear about this guy's first appearance with the choir, if he's the Jonathan Woodgate of the chorister
world. Yeah, what happened? Yeah.
Sounds like an absolute disaster.
His voice broke.
Yeah. Fell over in the middle of it. Yeah, I suppose you would. I mean, this is if you want to be the kind of glitziest and the most glamorous of the chorister world.
Just a relentless winning machine.
Term fees of nearly £7,000, so that might add to the Galactico nature, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, you'd like to think so. Yeah.
I mean, a Rolls Royce might work there, but the Real Madrid of the chorister world, I don't know if that would fill parents necessarily with confidence. Right, very important question, and very timely too, from Dominic Booth, Dave. He says, can we have a clamour update, please? Harvey Elliott versus Kobbi Mainoo for top clamouring looks like a real ding-dong battle. Well, one thing's for sure, Dave, I think we can remove Cole Palmer out of the clamour zone. But that doesn't mean he won't have a mid-tournament clamour, but that's a separate thing, and we'll get onto that in a couple of months' time. But so Cole Palmer is out of the clamour zone. He's presumably on the plane, on the train. So is Elliot versus Mainoo the clamour clash?
I don't think we should get ahead of ourselves with Cole Palmer. I know he's been on a brilliant form for Chelsea. Everyone's just assuming he's going to be nailed on, but it would be classic Southgate for him to go. I mean, I think he'll be in the squad, but it'd be classic Southgate for him to go and like not really get on the pitch pitch much.
Yes.
And so I do think the mid-tournament or early tournament clamour for Palmer will definitely still be the number one clamour. But Mainoo seems to have died down a little bit since he had that kind of bursting onto the scene, for want of a better phrase, in a few months ago. Harvey Elliott's a weird one. He's actually never been capped for the senior team. So seems a bit of a stretch for him to be the clamour subject.
I don't think that precludes a clamouring Nick not being capped. If anything, it enhances it.
I think it strengthens it, if anything. But yeah, would he be in the clamour zone if he hadn't scored that goal yesterday? I mean, I know this is kind of how it works, but it's a sort of, I know the clamour zone is by its nature a sort of transient thing and lots of recency bias going on, but
yeah, I mean, clamouring almost by its nature, Dave, is quite knee-jerk, isn't it? So a wonder goal does help your cause. It's going to put you front and centre, which is what clamouring is all about.
Yeah, it does. I just think you need a bit more. I don't know. I mean, I know Harvey Elliott's good.
Do we need him?
A good player,
I mean,
but he doesn't.
That's part of the clamour. Is he something we're missing? It's arguably he's not. His time isn't necessarily come. So that might count against him in a clamouring sense.
Yeah, I think it's a stretch for me, I think, at the moment.
Okay.
It looks like Calvin Phillips is now kind of out of the picture. Is it?
Yes.
With an injury. So I think that probably strengthens the clamour for Mainoo, doesn't it?
Yeah, maybe. I think he's going to be in the squad personally, but not in our remit to discuss that earnestly, so it doesn't matter. Right, time for the promised politics football crossover. Lovely little collection of stuff here. Top level and refreshingly top level stuff after all the nonsense that we've seen in previous months. Maybe that's because the election could be cometh-ing. Right. Anyway, Harry Rose has this excerpt from the Sunday Times quoting a Labour aide. They say, "You don't need to tell Keir to stay focused. He's like a football manager with 5 games to go in the title race, doing the quick fist pump to the crowd, then getting down the tunnel. No celebrating at this stage." Keezy's going to be happy with this one, Nick.
Keezy, one of those people who you absolutely convince won't be a Labour voter, but actually he turns out to be a Labour voter, like Nigel Pearson and Brexit.
Yeah, again, we shouldn't pigeonhole these people just on their ostensible... I can imagine a party leader having exactly this mentality, not wanting to get carried away in public and, you know, sort of turning to all their kind of senior MPs and tapping their head saying, "Oh, it's not won yet."
Absolutely. You can almost see Keir Starmer referencing Arsenal taking pictures in the dressing room or Newcastle taking pictures in the dressing room, but getting it wrong. He would, you know, he'd make a real sort of ham-fisted effort of referencing it, but I think that's definitely the mindset that they've adopted. What is down the tunnel in politics, though?
Back into your office?
Getting back into your car?
Back to Labour HQ. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, backstage after talking at the conference, maybe. Right, next up, this came from David. Here's BBC Breakfast ace Naga Munchetti with what I believe to be surely a world record length of setup for this very particular type of question. Let's start the stopwatch.
How confident are you, or are you confident, that the wins you have, or the gains you've made so far, particularly at the Conservative Party's expense, or Conservative expense, are down to apathy or fury with the Conservative Party, or the electorate being convinced that the Liberal Democrats have something to offer to them that they want? Do you see the distinction? Are they rejecting the Conservatives and saying, right, well, the Lib Dems are the alternative? Because we always talk about how the Lib Dems do pretty well in local elections.
It's
or
going.
Do you think your own message is getting through and convincing voters? Honestly, I think it's a bit of both.
A bit of both of what?
42.27 second build up to a bit of both has to be a world record.
So many clauses.
Yeah.
Good God.
Yeah. It's too many. There's way more than two options there.
Almost sabotaged it. Yeah, almost sabotaged it, didn't she, Dave?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that, I mean, I never thought I'd say these words, but Naga Munchetti reminding me of vintage Alan Brazil there.
Never a collection of words that will ever, ever again be uttered. Oh, wow.
Need to get Patrick Davidson to the BBC to give them some schooling on how to ask a slightly more concise question.
Yeah,
I think so. Right, final entry for this section came from Ben Campbell. This is really good, I think, but not without its pitfalls. Here's Stephen Noon, former strategist for the then managerless Scottish National Party, on where they go from here.
Is unity more important than perhaps a battle of ideas at this stage?
I think what's important is allowing the SNP to move out of its exceptionally defensive stance at the moment. So my reflection on the party over these last couple of years is like we're like a football team pinned into our own penalty box. Everybody is huddled around the goal, trying to defend a seat from a series of attacks. So what John Swinney offers, he's like a Willie Miller or an Alex McLeish. He's a strong, solid centre-back. He gets the defence in shape. And what that allows is you cut off attacks from the opposition, you stop some of the own goals, but you also allow people like Kate Forbes and Stephen Flynn to get out onto the pitch, get into positions on the pitch where they're actually able to create opportunities for the party. You don't win elections by being in a defensive stance. You win elections by having your people out on the pitch. You know, Stephen Flynn, centre forward for the Westminster election, Kate Forbes in the midfield causing problems on the opposition's right flank. I mean, this for me is the strategy for the party. Solidify the back and allow people to get onto the pitch and actually do their jobs.
Wow.
This goes way beyond what I expected it. Nick, we started with an analogy of a team camped in their own penalty area, sort of defending from attacks. Now, I thought that would be the extent of it. And then I thought what he was saying was that John Swinney was going to be like the outlet that was going to get them out. But no, he was going to be the linchpin of the defence. And I thought, okay, we really are stuck in the mud here. And then it started going off in all directions. How is he a former strategist? Get him in. Get him back in.
This sounds to me like an idea stemming from one of those, you know, if you had a team of, you know, they've had a long train journey at some point and someone's written at the back of a napkin or something like that. And a little light bulb, but okay, I'm going to store that for the next time I'm on the radio. When he started that, I was all ready to poo-poo it as another kind of clunking football analogy, but fair play. He's really thought this through. Superb.
Not without its issues, Dave. The use of stop the own goals was rather jarring.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a given, isn't it?
Yeah.
Don't do that.
No, exactly.
And also, you know, stopping own goals is never going to be a problem for a team. You know, the first thing they've got to do is stop the own goals.
How would a team, what would they be doing that would be kept leading them to scoring own goals?
Stop turning the ball in the back of your own net. I don't know. But otherwise, really liked it. You could see arrows. There were magnetic counters there. The detail there was what really brought it over the line. Well done, Stephen Noon. Right. Next up, Charlie writes in and says, can we have a word for these Solihull Moors fans who moved behind the goal at Wembley for the penalties to try and put the Bromley takers off, only to lose anyway? Now, there are two strands I want to assess here, Dave. First of all, you know, as a psychological move in a penalty shootout, you were there, of course. Did you think it was an effective thing to do? Did you think it was kind of signing your own death warrant in a penalty shootout to do that?
We were kind of talking amongst each other, the guys I was there with, when the referee was talking to the two captains about to do the toss before the penalty shootout, we were sort of going, they can't do it in front of the empty end, can they? Surely that's rubbish. It'll look terrible on TV.
You've got to trust the process. You've got to stick to the process.
You have
to
do the toss. So fine. And lo and behold, that's what happened. They won the toss and I don't know who chose, whether Solihull chose or whether Bromley chose to send them up the other end or whatever, but they went up that end. And then it was actually quite amazing to watch. It was a proper, like, one person went and everyone else followed, because there was a bit of that black netting separating the Solihull.
Oh.
Yeah, so there was, in theory, segregating them from no one, but there was some black netting to say this is where your end stops. And somebody just...
So it turned like Ninja Warrior, did it?
Yeah, somebody just crawled under it and then just started pulling it all up, and everyone just went en masse. But obviously in the end, it was fruitless. But the Bromley fans also tried to do a similar thing. They tried to get up there as well, because there was loads more Bromley fans than Solihull Moors fans.
Chaos.
At the game.
Yeah.
And the Bromley fans were all down the other end, and they tried to go up the side, but they couldn't get... They could only get to, like, the corner flag, really. They couldn't get round.
Oh, God. In vain. I mean, this leads me into my second issue with this, Nick, and maybe appropriately enough, given these two teams are striving to escape the clutches of non-league and join the real world, is that this is not befitting of Wembley Stadium. You shouldn't be able to just move around Wembley Stadium and pick other seats. This is the national home of football. I won't have this behaviour. Won't have it.
What's sacred ground? You should respect your allocated
seating. It's non-league behaviour. Just move. I mean, at non-league level, that's absolutely fine. Move around, get a better vantage point for yourself. But you're at Wembley Stadium. You can't just move to another part of the stadium and watch the game. So standards.
They're disrupting...
History, heritage.
they're disrupting the system. This is, you know...
Yeah.
We need this kind of thought.
Yeah. I just, you know, delighted to have a new name in the Football League, quite frankly, because I find it very refreshing.
Another sort of desperate measure that the Solihull fans took, this was mid-shootout when they missed their first two penalties, but they'd scored their third, and they were kind of, and then Bromley missed one. So they had a sliver of hope of getting back in it. And then I think it was for the fourth Bromley penalty, they decided to get their phones out and put the lights on their phones. And there was,
oh God,
but it was too light. It wasn't a night, you know, it was sort of...
Oh, I see,
it's
right.
A, you know, it's just a 3 o'clock kickoff. So it didn't really make much of an impact. And it was, the whole thing was very tin pot.
Not fucking Coldplay, lads, come on.
Anyway, speaking of tin pot behaviour, it's time for Keys and Grey Corner. Right, two lovely little entries for you here. First one comes from Nozza, of course, the best Keys and Grey archivist in Europe, possibly even the world. Here is his latest opus. It's 46 seconds of Andy Gray and Martin Tyler addressing each other in an ironically formal fashion.
And what about the England system, Mr. Gray?
I tell you, I think that may be one for the dubious balls, Mr. Tyler.
That's a very valid point, Mr. Gray.
With the greatest respect to Charlton, Mr. Tyler.
Maybe prophetic words from Mr. Gray.
Liverpool first, Mr. Tyler.
Often easier, Mr. Gray, for us to see it from up here.
Well, I have to see Mr. Tyler.
So it's a knee injury, Mr. Gray.
You cannot overstate, and you shouldn't try, Mr. Tyler.
That's a very good word, Mr. Gray.
There's a lot of similarities here, you know, Mr. Tyler.
Mr. Gray is blushing alongside me.
I'm not blushing, I'm chuffed. That's the heat.
Maybe, the blood pressure.
Calling someone Mr. X, it's such a weird strand of wry small talk, Nick. And in that compilation, there's no clear kind of pattern to the context in which they're doing it. Andy Gray just telling Martin Tyler which way they're kicking in a penalty shootout, for example. So, you know, it's all up for grabs. So in real life, in society, like, what's the context in which you would deploy, I don't know, a Mr. Hurry, for example? You see me after a long time, like a do, Mr. Hurry.
Yeah, but I think it is a sort of strand of blokes of that age, right, where they do sort of roll out this kind of slightly sarcastic, slightly kind of excessive formality.
Yeah. Also, just trying to work out the motivation for it. I don't know what compels someone to do that.
I could see that in the real world, like at work or something, if you hadn't come into the office for a while and like your boss was sitting there and you just strolled in one day, Adam, and said, Mr. Hurry, nice of you to join us.
I don't think the Athletic employs Count Dracula.
You can't really see this working with any other commentary duo, can you? Can you imagine if, like, Fletch started calling Steve McManaman Mr. McManaman or Mrs. Ward?
Mr. McCoist. Even that doesn't work. And he's the ultimate candidate to try it on. Yeah. And it just doesn't work. Mr. Gray, Mr. Tyler. Anyway, yeah, it's a great compilation and such a snapshot of a certain period of football commentary. Right, here are the two we really want to talk about, Keys and Gray. They had a long, long diatribe, Nick, you won't be surprised to hear, about VAR and officialdom in English football. And then it unravelled into this revelation.
The UK, and particularly the Premier League, and Howard Webb and his team need a good rethink this summer about what they're doing with that.
But the good news for Scottish football is that John Moss, who left the PGMOL recently, is now...
Excuse me? What?
Yeah, Moss is going to take charge of the referees in Scotland.
John Moss is going to... No.
Yes.
Who made that decision?
Well, I guess the Scottish FA.
Oh, wow. I despair. I despair. Good luck, Scotland.
Let's go.
The good luck, Scotland, at the end was brilliant. My thing with this, Dave, is that they're so obsessed with talking about referees and individual figures within refereeing. Beyond the having his name stitched into his boots, I don't reckon they've got any beef with John Moss. They are just so automatically inclined to think that all anybody, you know, connected to PGMOL is useless at their job. So yeah, that's it.
Mossy. Can you remember anything massively?
I can't remember anything John Moss has done, good or bad.
And he'll have made mistakes. It's a difficult job. But the thing about this clip is Andy Gray reacting as if that's the first time he's heard of it.
Why does he always do that?
No.
Really?
As if he hasn't been shown the running order beforehand.
There was another discussion they had, Nick, and Keezy loves to present this as a solution. He says, why don't we just get the best... European referees into the Premier League. Is there anything stopping us doing that? And as we said before, like with many Keyes' arguments, there's a strand of logic there that makes you think, actually, yeah, that actually does sound like quite a good idea, but he presents it in such a ridiculous way, such a indignant way, that you instantly disagree on the back of that.
It's strangely kind of un-Keyesian idea that the Europeans, they do it better.
Yeah, just blindly assuming. I don't know, maybe John Moss is rubbish, but there's nothing stopping him taking up an administrative role in Scottish football, as far as I'm concerned.
I think
he's going to bring it to its knees.
Exactly, I know. And I think it would be remiss of us to finish this episode of Keyes and Grey Corner without mentioning Keyes's blog last week, which dropped mid-record, but we didn't spot
right.
it. We didn't spot it. And he has christened Arnie Slot, Arnie Ten Slot. He's already moved on from Ten Hag. He's got his... He's got.
Did we not do that? Do we not?
No.
You're joking. Arnie Ten Slot. I mean, it's just too easy for him, Dave, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. But it is great. And I look forward to who knows how long, but there'll definitely be some mileage in it next season when it happens.
We'll find out in August, I imagine, very quickly. Cheers to you, Nick Miller.
Thank you.
Great adjudication panelling. Thanks a lot, Dave Walker.
Thank you.
And we'll be back on Thursday. See you then.